answer however you want. You have control of the interview. Simple. I hesitated, and Kofor could sense my uncertainty. Hank, you are the smartest CT guy in the entire government. Nobody knows more about this than you. You have lived it. You crushed AQ and the Taliban in a few weeks, for God's sake. You ran operations all over Africa against all kinds of assholes. Now you're worried about the press? Don't be such a pussy. Take the fucking job. Oh, and watch out for Rumsfeld. He's a ruthless son of a bitch. Yeah, that I know. Later, he snapped and hung up the phone. This was not about just my cover or leaving the agency. It was about walking away from my life's dream. Intelligence was my passion. The creed of spies stressed anonymity, not publicity. Ted Gupp, the author of The Book of Honor, The Secret Lives and Deaths of CIA Operatives, said, "It's hard for our entire culture to grasp the nature of this sacrifice. We live in a culture of celebrity, where what is not recognized does not exist." Spies, he added, come out of a culture where what is recognized ceases to exist. The light is lethal. If I moved to state, I did not plan on ceasing to exist, although some of the diehard veterans of the clandestine service might see it that way. In the new job, I'd be able to see intelligence from a different perspective, from that of the consumer. I could expand my horizons and serve my country in a different, perhaps larger way. A few other CIA clandestine service officers had made the switch, but not many. Then, of course, there was the impact on my family. I told Cindy about the possibility of the new job, the new life. She responded with her own set of questions. What do I tell our family, those who don't already know that you're a spy, our friends, our neighbors, our children's friends? What about our security? She demanded. These were not really questions, but rather declarations of my acute insensitivity. She had lived a life of cover, perhaps more difficult than mine. Now I was asking her to abandon the storyline that she had maintained and nurtured for 24 years on 4 continents. I was asking her to explain to all that her husband had never been just a minor government functionary. Instead, he was a spy and counterterrorism operative. Now he would be a diplomat. He would be an ambassador, not to any one country, but rather an ambassador at large. It would all come out because of the required open confirmation process in the Senate. There was no way around it if I took the job, a job that had not yet been offered. Well, maybe it will all be okay in time, I suggested, with no discernible impact on my audience. She had managed the entertainment of hundreds of foreign nationals at our various homes, from small dinners to huge garden parties. She had run counter-surveillance, dropped me off for agent meetings, and helped me remember all those names that I would otherwise forget. She had learned to cook warthog tacos, impala steaks, and eland roast. She had boiled and filtered water so it was fit to drink. She had battled malarial mosquitoes for years. She had tended to 3 boys who all, at one point, had that gut-wrenching, explosive dysentery common in sub-Saharan Africa. One time, in an African city street, she had fought off a purse snatcher with 1 hand while holding a baby in the other. She had cried over our convulsing, dying Labrador, poisoned by would-be burglars. Working unpaid and unrecognized with her spy husband and raising rambunctious boys in a string of foreign countries, she understood and embraced those missions. But this transition from spouse and partner of a covert operator to that of a public government official was unexpected, unknown, and bizarre. We both struggled to understand what such a shift would mean. Several weeks later, Secretary Rice asked to see me in her 7th-floor office. I was escorted across the large exterior office, appointed with antique furniture and rugs, into her small private office. dark wood and leather furniture. It reeked of power. She greeted me with proper, almost stiff formality. She sat a couple of seats away and crossed her arms. I had earlier told Zelico that I would take the job, so I wondered why she was not more relaxed. We had often engaged in discussions during 2001-2002, when she was the National Security Advisor, but always in small groups. I realized then that we had never met alone. In fact, we hardly knew each other. I also understood that her view of the CIA was not altogether positive. As we began our conversation, I reflected that in truth she was taking a huge leap of faith in asking me to serve in this capacity. She had every right to be cautious, because she did not really know me. I reviewed some of the points that I made to Zelico, but this time I brought PowerPoint shows to illustrate the enemy safe havens around the globe and our need to harness statecraft instruments in a regional approach. I shifted to sit beside Rice so I could show her the brief. "We need a regional approach," she agreed.
"And you want me to implement?" I asked.
"Yes."
"And I work for you directly?" I inquired.
"Yes, you work directly for me," she responded, but added, "You will also need to work with other elements of the department."
"You bet. Thank you for the opportunity to serve," I concluded.
We shook hands and I walked out of her office, knowing that my life as a spy was over. Still, there was President Bush's political team's vetting process, followed by my appointment, and then the Senate confirmation. Pending all that, I had a new mission. I had already informed Kappus of my possible departure from the CIA. I drove home and told Cindy. A few weeks later, the Senate confirmed me as the coordinator for counterterrorism. The process took 20 minutes. There were no contentious questions or commentaries. I was sworn into office that day, 1 August 2005. I was now on the policy side, a consumer of intelligence. No more clandestine missions. After all the years, it somehow seemed almost imaginary. I joined the CIA, learned the art of espionage, ran agent networks, collected valuable intelligence, executed global covert action, led men in war, and helped defend our country. I had lived the big dreams of a small boy. In other ways, it was all too real. I mourned the deaths of many. I struggled with the risks of espionage, covert action, and war. I endured the uncertainties and the errors of our foreign policies and our politics. But I loved my CIA mission, our opportunities seized, and our victories won. Most of all, I was honored and privileged to defend our Constitution and serve our great nation. May God bless America and her spies. We will need them more than ever. Epilogue. Rich sent me a text. Bin Laden dead. It was 1 May 2011, 22:32 hours Eastern Time. Rich and I had retired from the U.S. government in 2007 and started a global strategic advisory firm. The next year, Donna joined us. I stared at Rich's message, and after some long seconds, I smiled and nodded. Cindy, in Florida visiting her mother, called me a few minutes later. I was in Georgia visiting my parents. We had attended church that Sunday morning. My father and I had walked in the forest that afternoon.
"Are you watching TV?" Cindy asked.
"Yeah. After all these years, finally."
My parents joined me, and we watched the news unfold. Journalists started calling me nonstop. I turned off my cell phone. Many hours earlier, on the other side of the world, U.S. Navy SEALs in stealth helicopters sliced through the night, dropped into the Pakistan town of Abbottabad, breached the Al-Qaeda safe house, and shot Osama bin Laden dead.
He had been living there for years. The commandos also killed UBL's grown son, the primary courier, and the courier's brother. The SEALs grabbed an invaluable load of intelligence stored in documents, flash drives, and computers. They were on the ground less than 45 minutes. There were no U.S. casualties. The Pakistan government had no clue about the raid. Neither did all but a handful of U.S. leaders and clandestine operatives. Secrecy had preserved surprise and success. The CIA had found UBL after chasing hundreds of leads, recruiting sources, running unilateral surveillance teams, leveraging foreign liaison services, operating surveillance platforms, and relentlessly analyzing the raw data. Even then, CIA analysts were not certain UBL was at the site. CIA Director Leon Panetta, however, was confident enough. For several months, as more pieces came together,